Ah, that sound feels so good to hear again. The Eye on College Basketball, CBSSports.com, College Hoops Podcast theme music. But the games are still far away, but we couldn't stay away for too long. Parrish is here, and we wanted to go into the Calhoun stuff, a little bit of ACC, get the podcast flow back. Goodman was supposed to be on, but I think he said, you know what, I'm not even ready for this. So we're going to wait, I think, until October.
He bailed on us.
I know. Yeah.
Let's tell the real story. It wasn't like he didn't think he just bailed on us.
Okay, so we're going to totally kill him when he's not here to defend himself. Okay, that's totally fine.
I've made an entire career off of that, Matt Norland.
Yes, we have not gotten the band back together. It's almost like we're all on stage and Goodman's like the bass player and we're like getting ready to play the first tune and he like walks off. That happened to I think that happened to Soundgarden in like 96, not to get totally like musical and niche on people, but like Soundgarden like literally broke up in the 90s when I think their bass player was like F this and left during the middle of a show, and then they've gotten back together since then, but that's not what's happening here, I promise.
My first Soundgarden show, yeah, at the Pyramid in downtown Memphis. Opening up for, take a guess, do you know?
Give me the year. What was
1993,
the year?
I think.
93, Soundgarden opening up. Don't even tell me it's Nirvana. Is it Nirvana?
It is not Nirvana.
Rage Against the Machine?
It is not Rage Against the Machine. The correct answer, Matt Norlander.
Yeah.
Axl Rose in Guns N' Roses.
Oh, my gosh.
The Use Your Illusion Tour.
Yeah, they had crested the mountain peak by that point, but that's still pretty, pretty awesome, man. So wait, that was your first show or your first, that was just sound?
First Soundgarden show. My actual first concert ever was Bon Jovi and Skid Row at the Mid-South Coliseum. And I believe my second concert ever, you ready for this one?
Yeah.
Vanilla Ice.
Oh my gosh. We could seriously talk the whole podcast on first concerts. Mine was ZZ Top. I'm going to leave it at that. I'll save it for another time, but I was, I got separated from my parents. I was like 12 years old and got stuck next to, a couple that was a combined maybe 550 pounds, quite sweaty and full of, illegal whatnot, shall we say. But all right, let's go into hoops here, although we could really just gab on music and I would be totally cool with it. But all right, so let's just do Calhoun first. He's done. I personally, Gary, I was surprised. Now, listen, you can totally have the cynical view of it, and you wrote a column on it, and it's spot on. And there was a part of me that always believed that he would do this, that he would leave the way he did so that Ollie, the guy he wanted, was in there. But at the same time, I was a little surprised, and I think if he doesn't hurt his hip, he's still coaching. But let's expound upon what you wrote about on the site earlier this week and how, you know, what Calhoun's doing here, he deserves to take some criticism for the way he's leaving this program that he built up.
Well, and he should. I mean, listen, I know that you think that he would still be coaching if not for the fractured hip, and that might be true. There's no way I could definitively have a counter argument to that. But my guess is that once the real indication that he was going to retire to me was when the NCAA made it clear you're out of appeals. There's no getting around it. You will not coach in the 2013 NCAA tournament, no matter how good your team might be. He lost players because of that, on top of losing Jeremy Lamb and Andre Drummond. And the reality is, whether Jim Calhoun was coaching this version of Connecticut this year, or Mike Krzyzewski, or John Calipari, or Bill Self, or anybody, they were going to struggle to win games, particularly in a very deep and mostly talented Big East. Even if they didn't struggle, there's nowhere to go. So what are you playing for? What are you coaching for? You're 70 years old. Your health has failed you consistently over the past few years. And those are when you had talented rosters with some sort of goal to shoot for. Now you don't have a talented roster and no goal to shoot for. What are you doing? And so I think he was always going to drag it out with or without the hip fracture and make sure that he could hand it off to Kevin Ollie. And on some level, maybe that's a selfish thing to do, to put the university in a tough position. On another level, maybe it's an honorable thing to do to ensure that your guy gets the job. Either way, Kevin Ollie's got a hell of a task in front of him now, because it'd be one thing if the university said Kevin Ollie's our guy and he's got a 5-year contract and we want him to rebuild Connecticut basketball. Then go for it. He might be able to do that. But saying we're going to reevaluate after 1 year, that suggests that they're not sold on Kevin Ollie. And I don't know what he can do between now and next March to prove to them that he's the guy, because – most athletic directors simply look at win-loss records, and his is not going to be very good.
He is in an absolutely brutal spot. I have not talked with Ollie about this, you know, even off the record. I don't know if Goodman got a chance to get an off-the-record conversation with him yesterday, but I can't help but think that Ollie really was handcuffed. I think both parties were really handcuffed here, but this is ridiculous for him. And it's not even a year, okay, which even if it was just like a year, it's still not fair. But, you know, maybe in contract terms, they just do like a full year just for a full year's sake. Like, the contract ends, like, just as they're sweeping the confetti off the floor at the Final Four. You know, it's just as soon as the season ends, we'll evaluate him there. He's in an impossible spot. And who was it? I think someone was mentioned that Lute Olson, when he took the Arizona job, like coming off a team that had only 4 wins that year. And when you put UConn in this kind of spot, he's, I don't know, he seems to be set up to fail in this kind of spot. And I don't see how he is there long term with this kind of start from the get go, is basically what I'm saying. It would be different if the team could go to the postseason, if it was a preseason top 20 team easily, and if it was a different situation, you want to give them 1 year. It's still not fair, but it's like, okay, well, at least you have a chance. Gary, dude's got no chance this year.
It looks like it. There is no chance. I mean, in reality, most people are judged by their win-loss record. We see it every year. You know, how does John Gross get the Illinois job? You know, because he took a mid-major basketball program, you know, and made a run in the NCAA tournament. And suddenly, you know, he's the guy that – and it doesn't mean John won't be great there. I actually think John's really good. But had John, say, lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament or not made the NCAA tournament last year, he's not the head coach at Illinois right now. My point is this. Typically, athletic directors, they look at stuff like that, win-loss records, NCAA tournament success. That's how you get a job. That's how you prove your worth in this sport. Guys very rarely look deeper than that. And so when you start looking at on-the-court success, trying to evaluate Kevin Ollie at the end of this year, my guess is he's not going to have very much of it. The other problem that I think Kevin Ollie's going to run into here, besides just the fact that he's probably going to lose more Big East games than he wins, and he's got no option of trying to make a run through the NCAA tournament because that is off the table for APR reasons, is that Connecticut, and maybe they should, but I think that they have an inflated sense of what that job's going to demand on the open market. The columnist up there, Jeff Jacobs, who's really, really good,
yes,
and who knows that program really well and it's covered Calhoun, I think in a way that's admirable, because it is very hard to be a local columnist and go to bat consistently with somebody the stature of Jim Calhoun. Here in Memphis, Jeff Calkins, the columnist here, used to go head-to-head with John Calipari all the time, and that was a hard thing to do in this city because John was a god here, or at least considered that way, the same way he's now considered in the state of Kentucky. But Jeff did a tremendous job, holding Calhoun as accountable as you can hold Jim Calhoun in New England. That said, his column after Jim's announcement that he was going to retire was basically, they need to go hire a legend to replace a legend. And I think in theory, that would be great. But I don't know that that's possible. As we've seen over the past few years, whether you're Maryland or Illinois or NC State, other really, you know, historically relevant basketball programs, they've had trouble making hires. And unless you're Kentucky, UCLA, Indiana, maybe a Louisville, Kansas, Duke, Carolina, maybe about 6, 7, 8 programs in America, going and hiring a legend just doesn't seem to work. Nobody's even been able to hire VCU's coach or Butler's coach. Mm-hmm. So how are you going to go lure a quote legend or anybody thought of in that way to go to Storrs, Connecticut? I think that there are jobs that are great jobs, Indiana, UCLA, Kentucky, Carolina. And then I think there are programs that have become great because of the men who led them. And I think Connecticut is much more of the latter. I think Jim Calhoun has turned that into one of the top 10 basketball programs in America. I don't know that it's even one of the top 30 jobs in America. So Kevin Ollie might run into this situation. They think they can do better. They think they can go hire a, quote, legend. And maybe they'll prove me wrong, but my guess is they're going to be looking for the John Grosses of the world, the same way Illinois found themselves doing it. And at that point, would it have been wiser in hindsight to just commit to Kevin Ollie now and give him a fighting chance. Because under these circumstances, he, as you pointed out, I don't think he's got a fighting chance.
I find the conversation between jobs and programs fascinating. UConn is right now a top 10 program. It's not a top 10 job. We went through this with Maryland, which you can say could be the opposite. It's not a top 10 program, but it's a top 10 job specifically because of the location and now even with the inflated ACC conference, which we'll get to in just a second. But I want to ask you this. Okay, so Calhoun builds up UConn, right? And, I mean, it wasn't even UConn when he got there. It was Connecticut. It was just at one point it was part of the Yankee Conference or Yankee League, and it was a founding member of the Big East and whatnot. It was just a total afterthought. I said in my piece where I kind of postulated on the future of this program that it was basically then what Rutgers is today in the Big East. And what Calhoun did is so incredible. Okay, so think about it. He wins three titles. The fact that he turns UConn into what it is, okay? We grew up, I mean, Gary, you're young enough where we have only known UConn as a legitimate national relevant program, and it used to not be like that. So what if Calhoun had gotten Memphis? Think about Calhoun getting Memphis if for some reason 84, where he has all of that talent. I mean, UConn, you could say, is almost the total opposite of what Memphis is, because obviously it's in such a hotbed part of the country, and that city alone, you know, think about how good he could have been there. You know, national titles can be a fickle thing. Like, he might not have necessarily won more or had less, but I still am so impressed at what he did at UConn that if he'd had a different job, would he be even considered a greater coach than he is of what he did, or does UConn inflate his legacy because of what he did at that school?
The guy's a Hall of Famer, and he should be. I actually I think your point is well made. On the other hand, you look at it on the bigger picture, and how much better players could he have gotten over the years than the ones he actually got to UConn? Now, you know, he put dozens with the S at the end of guys into the NBA, everybody from Rudy Gay to Mecca Okafor to Ray Allen, Rip Hamilton, and most recently Andre Drummond and Jeremy Lamb. So though there is no natural recruiting base in Storrs, Connecticut, or the surrounding areas, not really. And a coach will tell you that that's the most important thing to making a job relevant. Beyond, you know, conference affiliation, television exposure, support from the administration. You know, you have kids who are just right in your backyard. Can you go get players? It's why everybody thinks the UCLA job is terrific. Players everywhere. It's why everybody thinks the Texas job is terrific. Players all through Dallas. In Memphis right now, there are six top 100 kids within 30-minute drive of the campus. Six top 100 basketball recruits within 30 minutes of the campus. The Memphis job is tremendous for a variety of reasons, but that's certainly one of them. So the idea that Jim was able to do what he did in Storrs, Connecticut, is off the charts. And to win three national titles with three completely different cores, I mean, it's hard to get one, period. And then you see, you know, like somebody like Billy Donovan get two, but it was basically the same team, just back to back. And that's a tremendous accomplishment, too. But to build a national championship team, actually march it through the tournament, then start over from scratch, do it again, start over from scratch, do it again. You know, one team was Rip Hamilton, one team was Emeka Okafor, one team was Kimball Walker. I mean, three totally different cores. It's tremendous. Now, so I think this week where everybody is, you know, Jim Calhoun's gotten a lot of attention, I think it would be almost universal praise for what he was able to do there, which is almost unparalleled in the history of the sport, particularly the modern era, if not for the fact that late in his career, they got caught red-handed cheating in recruiting. And I'm not talking about extra phone calls or a barbecue at the house. You know, they used a booster turned agent to essentially buy a player. And Jim Calhoun was, if you believe in phone records, right smack dab in the middle of it. I know that he had plausible deniability on some level, but you talk to the guys who reported that story at Yahoo. You talk to the people who really know the ins and outs of the recruitment of Nate Miles, and Jim Calhoun was involved. And, you know, I'm not saying that Connecticut's the only program in America to only to ever use an agent or a booster, or in this case, a guy who actually qualifies as both, to use extra benefits to get a player. I think it's gone on quite often. I think it's gone on in double-digit programs. I think it's probably going on right now as we talk. But here's what I can tell you. regardless of what you think about John Calipari or Scott Drew or any of the other guys who showed up on our list of perceived cheaters last month, they've never been caught doing that. They've never actually been charged with a major violation as it comes to recruiting. They've never been caught using a booster or an agent to buy a player. Jim Calhoun's program was caught doing exactly that. So then you start to extrapolate from that story. If they clearly cheated in the most disgusting way, at least according to the NCAA, using money and trips and flights and hotel rooms and extra benefits to get a guy on campus. It's one thing for a kid to get extra benefits when he's on campus because that goes on a lot. But you lured him to Storrs, Connecticut with extra benefits from a booster slash agent. Once you know that that is true, and that is true, was Nate Miles really the first one? And a guy who coached there for 26 years, in year, say, 22 or 23, that's when they decided to start, buying players. Nate Miles wasn't even one of the top 10 recruits in the history of Connecticut basketball. So maybe it's not fair for people to talk like that. Like, well, how did he build something out of nothing in Storrs, Connecticut? Probably the same way he got 8 miles to campus. Though might not be fair on some level for people to suggest things like that. The reality is because he was once caught red-handed and leaves the program on probation because of that incident, people are going to speak that way, at least outside of New England. And it is very much a part of his legacy, just like everything else.
Quick little side note to the end of his career. In the wake of, and I'm not by any means comparing one school to the other, I'm just comparing commentary from what we've seen in the past year. In the wake of the Paterno statue coming down at Penn State, and Calhoun, he's so revered in the state. I live in Connecticut. I just wonder if something like a statue will happen. And if it does, what does that say? Not that it's right or wrong if it happens, but, everyone was talking about how we shouldn't be godding up coaches. They shouldn't be earning statues and whatnot. And if it does happen sometime in the next 2 or 3 years, there's certainly a cynical reaction to if indeed that does happen.
Oh, it will happen. And you know what? I mean, despite everything I just said, I won't be the guy like writing the column saying I cannot believe the school is stupid this level. Listen, I don't know how I feel about statues of basketball coaches in general or football coaches. I mean, there's one of Nick Saban right
already
now in Tuscaloosa. Yeah. So I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, we could have a whole conversation about, should we really be building statues? In other countries, they have statues of kings and generals. We have statues in our country of baseball players and football coaches and basketball. And so if you want to have that conversation, that's a conversation worth having. But once we already know that this is what we do, for right or wrong, this is America, Jim Calhoun deserves a statue as much as anybody else. And in reality, though, he leaves at a time when everything I'm about to tell you is true. He left the program on probation. He left the program banned from the NCAA tournament because he apparently didn't demand the same sort of excellence in the classroom that he did on the court. He essentially is given credit or blame on some level for firing his athletic director 13 months ago. Yep. Once you know all those things about the guy, that taints the way that he walks away. He essentially held the university hostage, by making it drag this late, into September, where we're basically only about a month away from the start of practice, or even less at this point. Those are all part, that's all things that we talk about now. But like Willie Mays, used to fall down at the end of his career in Major League Baseball. Eventually, we forget the end and we do start to take a picture of the 26 years in total. And as far as being an accomplished basketball coach over a nearly career that stretched, at least at Connecticut, for nearly 3 decades, the guy was off the charts. And I think in New England right now and across the country, as time moves on, he'll be thought of and talked about as one of the very best of all time. And I do think he is one of the very best of all time. And the other stuff will be not dismissed, but discounted in some way over the years. And we'll have a ceremony at some point unveiling a Jim Calhoun statue on campus and probably deservedly so. What he did there in terms of strictly of basketball is really one of the great building jobs in the history of the sport.
Now, one last thing before we go to the ACC. You're right with a lot of what you said, but I always find it interesting how everyone brings up, you know, we remember the good parts of the career, and that does stand out. But everyone remembers Willie Mays stumbling around the outfield. Everyone remembers Jordan with the Wizards. Everyone remembers that Joe Namath went to the freaking Rams. So I still think that'll still be a part of it. Those kind of awkward endings tend to linger in our mind, even if they aren't at the forefront of the overall story and in that lead paragraph, so to speak. Let's go to the ACC. That was really the big story before the Calhoun tidal wave took over the rest of the college basketball and even college sport conversation for all this week. So you and I had a little bit of a disagreement at our CBSSports.com College Hoop Summit. Not even a disagreement, but I think we were on different levels in terms of how good we thought the Big East was going to be going forward in regard to the A-10, and we won't really get on the A-10 right now. But now, since that conversation or quasi-debate, Notre Dame's out of the Big East. We still don't know what year that's going to be. I think it's going to be next year, personally. I don't see why they're going to do this awkward dance, but we'll see. So now the ACC gets a nice little uptick. You know, Notre Dame doesn't make the ACC great, but it's not bad for it. I said it's like the mashed potatoes in a meal. You kind of forget it's there, but they always seem to enhance the dinner, so to speak. So, one, any shock to the Notre Dame move? Two, I guess assess both leagues there. And then three, do you really think the ACC is going to be content to have that odd number 15 team league going forward?
Well, let's start at the top. Surprised that it happened this week? Yes, because I didn't really see it coming. I don't think anybody did, really, including, you know, the new Big East commissioner, Mike Oresko, who apparently didn't find out that Notre Dame was leaving the Big East affiliation for the ACC until the morning it was happening. So this was kept under pretty good wraps. Not surprised, though, in the larger sense of that Notre Dame found a new home for its non-football sports. I think this had been written about for about a year, that clearly the Big East has taken a hit. And I think last September, when you saw Syracuse and Pittsburgh decide to take all sports out of the league, you know, the first round of conference realignment, you know, cost the Big East Boston College and Virginia Tech and Miami. And those were, you know, some very good football programs, specifically Virginia Tech and Miami, and some good markets in terms of Boston and Miami television-wise. It didn't really hurt much basketball-wise. So I don't think there was this rush to, like, get Notre Dame's, you know, basketball program into another league. But when you lose, you know, Pitt and Syracuse, I mean, you're losing, you know, two more, you know, long-time members in all sports and two nationally relevant basketball program. So I'm not surprised that Notre Dame looked to go to the ACC. Now, what does it all mean? I think it was a story that was like, woo, because it was Notre Dame and it was, you know, conference realignment, and it sort of hit on all these buttons that we tend to pay attention to, certainly in this era of college athletics. But what does it actually mean? And I think if we've learned anything, television, as the Big East is negotiating its television contract right now with ESPN, maybe later with CBS, NBC, and who knows, everything's about football. And so the idea that you're just losing Notre Dame in basketball, I don't think it's going to have much effect on the Big East television contract. You know, I live in a city that's about to become a member of the Big East, and so we talked about this on my radio show here in Memphis. Would it have been better, you know, to have Notre Dame than to not have Notre Dame? Of course. You'd rather have Notre Dame than not if you're the Big East. But what does it really mean in terms of the bigger picture of the league, that they're going to get, what, 7 bids to the NCAA tournament instead of 8 or 6 instead of 7 or 5 instead of 6? You know, I think Notre Dame had just won 2 NCAA tournament games over the past decade. So though Mike has done a really good job there and had a ton of regular season success, this is not like, in my opinion, you know, losing Georgetown basketball program or Louisville's basketball program or Connecticut's basketball program. So I think it's a story that was nationally relevant. But in terms of what does it actually mean, it makes the Big East a little weaker, makes the Notre Dame, makes the ACC a little stronger. And that's probably the extent of it.
Yeah, I think it's just another whack of the axe at the tree, so to speak. Big East is still fine, not what it was. It's not crippled, but, you know, What's to be next? I don't know. Anyway, that's going to wrap up the podcast. Yes, it is nice and abnormally short with Parrish on, but we are actually, for full transparency, getting this thing in right before his radio show. So this was almost like an appetizer, because you got to go talk for 2 more straight hours, which I know isn't a problem for you, buddy, but well, I don't want to get you out for a few minutes. You know,
I'll get through it. Memphis apparently is about to get a commitment this weekend, perhaps from a kid named Pookie Powell. So if you don't If you don't think I can get an entire two-hour radio show out of the name Pookie Pal, well, then just get the podcast later on. You'll see.
Pookie Pal, that's great. All right, well, we'll swing back into the regular Wednesday rotation here in a couple of weeks with the season, shockingly, less than a month away for official practices. All right, buddy, go enjoy the show. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, my man, I'll see you.
All right, we'll be back on the podcast, yes, next week, a show that quick. We're going to turn stuff around, talk a little bit about recruiting, some stuff that's changed with NCAA rules, and even more going forward. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.